The Brief is supported by Bloomberg Connects, the free arts and culture app. Calls for new public ballots on all tall buildings over 60 metres. House building drops to its lowest level since the pandemic. Single-sex toilets to be required in all new public buildings in England. And Norman Foster calls on architects worldwide to help reconstruct Kharkiv. My name is Merlin Fulcher, I'm an architectural journalist, and I'll be bringing you a roundup of this week's big stories in architecture, planning and housing news. Welcome to The Brief from Open City. My guest this week here at Bureau in Design District is Alper Dipani. Alper is an architect and head of strategic planning and design at the London Borough of Waltham Forest. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Merlin. Good to be here.
A leading right-wing think tank has slammed the UK's mania for tall buildings and is demanding a planning policy overhaul, including a new public vote on towers over 60 metres. This was reported by the AJ. The Policy Exchange report, it's dubbed a policy framework for responsible high-rise and better density, condemns what it describes as the indiscriminate proliferation of tall buildings in the UK in the past two decades, which it says is happening against the wishes of most residents and under a false pretense of solving the housing crisis. Among a list of seven recommendations to government, Policy Exchange proposes a mandatory tall buildings policy in all local authorities across England and Wales, a ban on tall buildings in conservation areas, and a mandatory but non-binding public vote on all tall building proposals over 60 metres. The 135-page report, written by practicing architect, author and architectural critic Ike Iger, who is head of housing, architecture and urban space at the think tank, says the epicentre of the high-rise trend has been London, with 107 of the country's 129 buildings over 111 metres tall. But the report insists significant aftershocks have been felt as far away as Manchester and Leeds. The report says that while 67% of towers above 111 metres in London are now residential, compared with just 33% before the year 2000, the city's total of 68 towers built in this category since 2000 have seen just 6% affordable housing provision and around 0.3% social housing provision. It says this is despite a significant motivating factor for these towers, or so we've been told, is that they are urgently needed to help address the housing crisis. Policy Exchange says this surge in tall towers for housing also makes an erroneous conflation between high-rise and high-density, ignoring academic research which proves that mid-rise developments are more efficient to optimise density and maximise housing supply. The report explains, quote, Abel and Cleland House is a 13-storey modern mansion block in Westminster, yet it contains more than twice the density of the infamous Brutalist Trellick Tower in nearby North Kensington, which at 32 storeys is almost three times its height. Okay, so Alper, what's this all about? Policy Exchange's polling claims that 71% of the public think tall buildings should not be permitted to interfere with historic views, and that 41% thought London's skyline had been worsened by tall buildings. So, is a public vote on new towers long overdue?
Well, my first reaction when I hear statistics like that is, which public and what was the question? You know, was it, do you think tall buildings harm heritage? Or was it, do you agree we need to build more homes? Or do you agree there's a finite availability of land on which we have to deliver high quality housing? Or was it, do you believe that the need for new homes requires some kind of alteration to our existing fabric? So, you know, there's more clarity needed about what exactly was the question there. But what is really interesting is some of the things that Policy Exchange talk about already exist. So one of their recommendations is for a mandatory tall buildings policy in all local authorities. But that already applies in London. So the London Plan has a tall building policy, Policy D9 for the nerds, which has lots of detail on character, on context, on design, microclimate, views, etc. And it makes clear that development plans in London, so all those local plans produced by the boroughs, need to define what a tall building is and where it can be located in the borough, balancing character and growth or capacity for growth. So in Waltham Forest, we just recently had our local plan adopted and I helped draft the tall building policy in there. We spent a huge amount of time refining that policy and the wording and making sure that wording was scrutinised. And it was scrutinised in microscopic detail as part of that adoption process to get it right, because we know that tall buildings can make a positive contribution to character and the skyline. And we have to make the best use of land so that we can accommodate the population that all evidence tells us we're projected to have. And I mean, their gotcha statistic is that there are more residential towers in London now than there were 20 years ago. Well, of course, because we have a finite, you know, availability of land and we have a growing population. So, you know, London has a very good planning regime thanks to the London Plan. So if Policy Exchange are advocating that the other local authorities across the country follow the GLA's example when it comes to plan-led development, then that's all good. And, you know, as far as the public vote goes, I think by now that we've all learned that the hard way, that binary questions about nuanced subjects just don't get us very far.
And just like quickly, if we look at it, like, obviously there's a NIMBYism element. People are always going to be a bit scared about anything new. And a tower is obviously a big new thing in their area. But like anecdotally, people often just point to the towers, new towers, and they say, oh, you know, it's just luxury flats. It's not for people like us. And the report says like 0.6% of these tall buildings was social housing. From a planning perspective, the work you do, is there any way you could like mandate, oh, yeah, you can build a tall tower, but it has to be social housing, or, you know, it has to be like, you know, genuine social provision? Is that the crux of the issue here?
Yeah, but we have those policies. So in London, there is the policy of 35% affordable or 50% affordable unless you go through a sort of viability assessment. So these policies do exist. It's not the case that we would build, certainly in Waltham Forest, any towers, any housing development that doesn't have an affordable provision, which would need to meet that minimum 35%. And we exceed that on some sites as well. And that is the directive across London. But obviously, there are different political regimes across the capital that mean delivery can alter. But I would want to interrogate some of those statistics, because I don't think it's the case that all of tall buildings being built are simply market sale properties.
So it could be that the tall building scheme includes some sort of like mid-density stuff nearby, which is affordable and social.
Well, no, it would have to be on site. So as part of the development, you would expect to see a provision of affordable housing as well. And then within that affordable, you might break that down into shared ownership, but also social rent or London living rent, or, you know, so there are lots of different kind of breakdowns of what that affordability means as well. So the idea that you would build out a development of homes and it would all be 100% market sale is just not the case. Certainly in London, it's not the case, because we have those policies from the London Plan.
So the report, it really bemoans the impact of these tall buildings on the historic fabric of cities, especially London and Manchester, which it says has been, like, quote, recklessly squandered and sometimes wrecked in favour of inappropriate and poorly designed high-rise development, end quote. The report even blames the threat of tall buildings for Liverpool being stripped of its World Heritage status in 2021. Right now in London, we know there's like a fierce debate going on around proposals for a 43-storey tower right next to the 323-year-old Bevis Mark Synagogue in the City of London. I mean, anecdotally, I'd say you travel around London and say like Kensington and Chelsea, which famously doesn't have many tall buildings. They are some of our most beloved like heritage locations. Now, I love the World's End Estate, which is in Chelsea, but then there's other bits of London where there's no tall buildings, and it can feel quite charming and interesting. So like, what do you think of that argument? Are tall buildings really just always going to have a big impact on heritage, and sadly a negative one?
Well, I don't disagree that poorly designed high-rise development exists and that it negatively impacts character. But poorly designed low-rise development also exists, and that also impacts character, and it blights not just townscape, but it blights life. And all buildings, tall buildings and not tall buildings, should be built well, should be designed with care to the context and the character and to people and to planet as well. And I do recognise that that synagogue in particular is surrounded by some extremely tall buildings in the city. And so that kind of pressure is really easy, it's very tangible. But what's really interesting about Bevis Marks is the ornate and the rich interior that it's got. And you know, more than the building itself, the fact that the specific community has kept it in use for centuries. So it obviously serves their purpose well. And that's the lesson to take away. We need to ensure that all buildings are designed well and that they serve communities well. That's the principle that we should be taking away from this.
So it's really interesting. If we sort of delve into the report, it obviously argues that these tall buildings boom hasn't really done much to help the housing crisis, despite like major rhetoric always saying, like, you need to approve this thing, you know, we need more homes. There's an interesting foreword endorsement by the president of the Victorian Society, Griff Rees-Jones. And he wrote, quote, The harsh truth is that when sites get fiercely expensive to buy, investors, the real tune callers here, go upwards in search of profit, or even these days, outwards, with gross, distended tulip and walkie-talkie shapes, seeking a few more lucrative square feet at high level. It's driven by greed. Greed for on-paper square meter returns. Like, is that a fair criticism? Because, you know, we know property development is, you know, can be quite lucrative industry. And when you look at these proposals, one can often think, well, the reason they want this number of floors and so on is to do with the spreadsheet rather than to do with everything you just said in the answer to your previous question.
You know, land is a finite resource. We have a growing population, and building at the moment is very expensive, right? It's expensive to construct buildings at the moment. The economic environment that we have means that in order to deliver high quality homes, including affordable homes, the numbers have to stack up. And an element of cross subsidy from market sale is just inevitable. And I'm not saying that's a perfect system, but it is the one that we have. And you can say, well, the economic model sucks. And, you know, I don't disagree with that assessment. But in a time of need, when there's an urgent need for quality, secure, affordable housing, I think you have to engage in the reality that exists. And that reality involves ensuring that development is plan-led and that as part of what comes forward, you are delivering on the needs as well. So affordable housing, but also things like, you know, good quality public spaces, play space and all the rest of it as well. And you will not get any of those things without development. That's the economic model that we have at the moment.
I guess it doesn't help that in like some localities you have these tiny, tiny sites in like a location where there are no towers whatsoever. And then like a highly speculative developer comes along and like tries to just build big on it. Often like quite brazenly, you know, defying local plan policies or whatever. And then there's like a kind of trauma around it where lots of people have this idea this huge thing's going to come and like ruin the character of their neighbourhood. And it does rather kind of sort of doesn't really do the arguments you're putting forward much favour when people do have the freedom to almost use the planning of tall buildings as a kind of way to, you know, psychologically manipulate or terrorise people in some ways, you know?
Yeah, and I'm not saying that fear is not unfounded, but the point about plan-led development, and bearing in mind the current London plan, was only adopted a few years ago, and the tall building policies that hook onto it from the boroughs are only just coming into action now. They're very clear that local authorities need to assess where is the best place in the borough that tall buildings can go, you know, and that needs to be evidence-based. So you shouldn't see a situation where tiny sites that are in conservation areas or next to very low-rise streets, etc., would see, you know, huge buildings coming forward. Because the point about good plan-led development is that you plan ahead so that, you know, you make strategic decisions that avoid that kind of conflict.
House building was down in 2023 for the first year since the pandemic, new data reported in the AJ has revealed. So newly released Office for National Statistics data, analysed by property development appraisal website Appraio, reveals UK house building figures fell in 2023 for the first year since 2020. Last year saw an 11.8% year-on-year dip in the number of new homes delivered, following two previous years of positive growth. The figures showed 189,260 permanent dwellings were completed across the UK in 2023, compared with 214,589 in 2022. While the total number of homes built was marginally higher than the 20-year UK annual average of 188,290, the figure marked the end of 2 years' growth in housing delivery levels. The last time there was a year-on-year drop in the delivery of new homes was 2020, when complications due to the pandemic caused the figure to drop to 173,584. The 2023 house building nosedive was most pronounced across both Wales and Northern Ireland, according to Appraio, with annual figures dipping by 22.3% and 21.3% respectively. Appraio Chief Executive Daniel Norman put the slump in delivery of new homes down to higher interest rates, untamable inflation and a cooling housing market. He added, while 2024 is set to be a more stable year, market conditions are predicted to remain subdued until interest rates do start to reduce. He also warned that another year of muted housing delivery was likely. The data backs up recent analysis by industry tracker Glenigan, which reported the number of social housing projects starting on site had fallen 43% in the last quarter and by 40% against last year's figures. Okay, so Alpa, what's this all about? Why are house building levels back on the decline? And what sort of impact will this have on the UK's already perilous housing crisis?
Well, I don't think anyone can be surprised by the dip in delivery. I think it would be a surprise if house building had accelerated given the huge shocks that we've had to our economy in a very short amount of time. So firstly, Brexit. That's impacted cost of materials, supply chains, and that affects overall programme. But worst of all, it's impacted labour. So we have a vastly more restrictive immigration regime now. You know, freedom of movement in Europe doesn't exist for us. So that has turned off huge numbers of the construction workforce. And it might have been worth the hassle of seeking settled status, etc., for people who are not British, if the money was good, but wages have stagnated here. So there was a time when it made sense if you were a Polish builder to come and work in England. But that now, with the cost of living here, that time is over. So labour is a huge problem. And then secondly, the ongoing war in Ukraine. So as well as obviously being devastating in its own right, that war has had a significant impact on the cost of construction materials. So that affects the cost of construction, obviously. And then thirdly, interest rates. So following the trust budget, that was a huge shock to our economy. It caused a massive spike in interest rates, but also just volatility. So the rates changed so quickly, and that encouraged a sort of sense of prudence, so a sense of people waiting to see what would happen. Are interest rates going to come down? If you think rates are going to come down, then of course you're going to wait it out. So that means you'll put projects on pause. So the biggest impact of that, of course, has been on council-led housing development. The cost of borrowing has increased hugely for local authorities, but at the same time, local authorities are in a crisis of having to deal with their budgets, you know, manage more adult social care, more acute shortage of housing, and less money coming in. And then added to that, there's just the risk of bankruptcy. So it's really difficult for local authorities to defend any kind of borrowing in that context. And that has obviously put a lot of building projects on ice as well. And then fourthly, a bit more niche, but then the second stair guidance for tall buildings. So there was a huge amount of ambiguity when that was first mooted by Michael Gove. And it was only actually made a requirement in July. Until then, there was a lot of uncertainty. So that has slowed things down while developers, architects, local authorities were waiting for some certainty on what the actual decision was. You know, if you had a scheme that had one stair, if you're thinking that you might have to alter for a second stair, but you're not sure, you're going to wait. You know, you wouldn't want to build a building that's not going to meet regulations. So that slowed things down, but also it's meant that all those schemes that had permission have come back into planning to accommodate the new guidance, which is good, and we need that guidance. But, you know, that has an effect on programme. And except for that last issue, which, as I said, is now resolved, all of those other things still remain an issue. They're not resolved, you know, so it's unlikely that development is going to pick up in pace anytime soon, unfortunately.
One of the things that's interesting about this, obviously, homes being delivered 22, 23, yeah, they were projects which were approved even earlier before prices really went crazy. Like, anecdotally, prices are like twice, if not three or four times what they were in 2019. Like, what does it look like in your expertise as well as a planner? How does anyone make the decision in 2024 to go ahead with a project when prices are that high? Could this downturn be even worse than we're anticipating?
I don't know if it will be worse, but it's certainly going to be a period of pause because there is still chatter about, you know, interest rates still could come down, they may stagnate. They haven't gone up, they have come down a bit, but they haven't come down to the levels that people would like. So there's obviously a lot of kind of waiting to see, you know, where the land is going to lie. But as I say, the biggest impact is obviously on local authorities. There was a huge upsurge in local authorities building because the borrowing cap was removed a few years ago. So that's where you start to see a lot of council-led delivery. But obviously, if the borrowing rate goes for a local authority from 2% to 6%, that has a massive impact on, you know, your ability to deliver housing without going into debt. And as I say, there's all that decision making that has to go in local authorities at the moment, because, you know, lots of local authorities are going bankrupt. Since COVID, the need for things like adult social care has massively skyrocketed, but the money coming in is not commensurate with that before. And last time I came on here, I said a statistic which I'll repeat again, but in the, you know, in the 10 years between 2010 and 2020, local government saw 60p in the pound reduction of investment from national government. So a massive reduction in the money coming in, but a huge increase in the services that councils have to pay for.
So obviously, talking about local authorities, so this news of a fresh house building downturn comes as the government announced new land buying powers for councils this week. The government hopes it will enable them to deliver thousands more social and affordable homes. The reforms, which came into effect on Tuesday, will allow councils opportunities to buy land for affordable housing development at cheaper prices through the use of compulsory purchase orders and scrapping the inflated hope value costs. So Alper, what sort of impact will these reforms have? Are they enough to make a real difference for what you've already outlined of very cash-strapped local authorities?
Well, I think I'm going to have to file this under more info needed. I mean, firstly, I've never actually heard the term hope value. I don't know if it is one that gets bandied around, but I haven't heard it personally. But I'm guessing it's something related to viability and, you know, the idea of potential profit. So if these reforms equate to better transparency around viability, viability assessments, etc., then sure, that's a good thing. But in London, the idea that there are great swathes of land that could be developed if only they could just be like snatched up at a good price, I'm not sure that that is the case. I mean, plan-led development means setting out where you think new homes and workspaces, improved green space, etc., should be located. And then it's about the local authority working with a landowner on a really long-term strategy to achieve that. So that's what's needed, is dialogue with landowners. You know, as I understand it, compulsory purchase is not a straightforward process. So I think we just really have to wait and see. I mean, I think the most revealing part of this press release was the quote from Kate Henderson, CEO of the House Building Federation, who said, "This might help, but what we actually really need is, quote, a fully funded long-term plan for housing." So I think that's where the effort needs to come, really.
The UK government has announced changes to building regulations in England, requiring all new non-residential buildings, such as restaurants, offices, hospitals, etc., to provide separate male and female toilets. This news was covered in The Guardian. This move, aimed at addressing privacy concerns in gender-neutral facilities, comes after a public consultation where 81% reportedly supported separate facilities. The new regulations mandate the inclusion of dedicated male and female toilets in all newly built non-residential buildings, with universal toilets, i.e. single, fully enclosed cubicles with wash basins, remaining an option only where space limitations exist. The Equalities Minister, Kemi Badenoch, said the new rules will help counter an increase in gender-neutral toilet spaces, which she said, quote, deny privacy and dignity to both men and women, end quote. However, the policy, which was first mooted in 2021, has drawn criticism for potentially neglecting the needs of transgender and non-binary individuals. Campaigners for trans rights have highlighted the importance of gender-neutral facilities for some transgender people who may experience discomfort or discrimination in binary toilets. The government maintains that the new regulations, alongside the availability of universal toilets, ensure accessible sanitation for all genders. Okay, so Alper, what's this all about? With so many existential crises going on right now, why is the government focusing in on such a specific detail about the design and construction of new public buildings in England?
So it just feels like the pile-up of real issues is so big and the energy left to present solutions to them is just so low that this is where we're at now. This is like the level of our political discourse. And, you know, of course, this is divisive. How is it even going to be policed? There are so many things that need actual policing that are being neglected. So what purpose this serves to actual society and communities right now, I don't even know.
And just like as a precedent, is there any example of government getting this involved in the design of public buildings? I mean, I suppose there's the second stair emergency escapes there in residential, but are we seeing more like direct kind of almost like micromanaging of architects by government in the present era? Or has this always been the case?
I'm not sure. I wonder, I mean, we have a government that's had so many changes. I wonder if you don't have that longevity of ministers that are sort of committed to a portfolio and a brief and really know the issue. So they're just kind of like plucking at ideas and then saying, oh, this could be a good idea or that could be a good idea. I mean, I think it's a reflection of that you know, you don't have the experts, as it were, anymore.
It's like government by headlines, like
something like
bring
that.
Back school milk.
Yeah, or like, yeah, exactly. Or like, no more school milk.
Nationalise the M6 toll road.
Yeah, like, I think it's a bit more like that. And, you know, it's just trying to grasp a headline and, you know, potentially not a very good time for current government.
Okay, so like looking at the bigger picture around toilets, recent months have seen campaigning organisations such as the London Society really piling pressure on politicians around the lack of public toilets in public spaces more generally. So like they're quoting data that shows that an estimated 90% of Londoners surveyed feel that public toilet provision is inadequate to meet their needs. So why is it like apparently sort of so much easier, so much more readily something that the government will do, weighing in on debates around the design of public toilets in public buildings, than it is for politicians to actually do something to mandate the very existence of public toilets at all, where and when people actually need them?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's much easier to make a kind of dog whistle to a sort of culture war type topic than to commit to the long-term maintenance of good toilet provision, isn't it? So, you know, an actual good toilet strategy would contribute to feelings of dignity. You know, access to toilets really is an equalities issue, but it requires investment, you know, not just money, but like commitment, you know, that investment of time and energy to an idea of a cohesive and happy society. And that is just not the mood music right now. But also, are they even going to do it? I know this is a sort of headline about this requirement, but is there going to be follow through on it? We don't know yet. You know, it's just a headline at the moment.
If I was standing to be mayor of London in some fictional future and I said, I'll put a public toilet in every London Underground station, I reckon that would be a winner, surely. Like, isn't there the political pressure? Because if you've got like majority of people say there aren't enough loos, how come that doesn't translate into any real change?
I'm putting my two pence in here, but I think because no one wants to commit to being responsible for it. If you've got a toilet, you've got to clean it, manage it, make sure it doesn't have ASB. And there are all kinds of problems associated with that. And, you know, we should be able to work creatively to resolve that because other countries have. I mean, Japan is a great example. They've got toilets everywhere and they're fine. They're perfectly usable and clean and whatever. So we know it's possible, but there's just a failure of imagination to do positive things right now.
Yeah, and I think just anecdotally, I remember I was visiting a city in Poland and there were like public loos everywhere, and I got on a city bus, just like a normal, like their equivalent of the red double-decker bus, and there was a toilet on the bus. Yeah, and I just thought, you know, if you can build a bus with a loo, surely London, you know, you could buy them, and you know, if they can do it there, they can do it here. Like, what's the big issue?
No,
like,
absolutely.
And how that would transform people's lives.
Yeah.
Okay. The Norman Foster Foundation has launched an open international contest to rebuild housing and public spaces in Kharkiv, Ukraine. Organised by Buildna in collaboration with Kharkiv City Council, UNECE, ARUP and the Kharkiv Architects Group, the competition seeks proposals for innovative modular solutions that could be used to retrofit existing concrete panel housing blocks and to revitalise public spaces. So it's called the Kharkiv Housing Challenge. It's been launched 2 years after Norman Foster met the mayor of Kharkiv to discuss reconstruction. And the competition aims to boost the eastern Ukrainian city's recovery and resilience. And it will see the winning concepts move from concept through to construction. Kharkiv is the second largest city in Ukraine. It's been the focus of significant fighting, shelling and missile strikes amid the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The contest site is in Saltivka, which is a large suburb on the northern fringes of Kharkiv. It's home to around 400,000 people and it's been heavily damaged as a result of the conflict. Proposals will need to offer ways to retrofit existing concrete panel housing blocks and to improve public spaces to create safe, energy efficient and vibrant neighbourhoods. Along with modular facade and roof components, bomb shelters and additional uses in the ground floors will also be required. Okay, so Alper, what's this all about? What do you think of this contest brief, which invites architects to retrofit and upgrade both existing and war-damaged concrete panel buildings across Kharkiv?
I have mixed feelings. I mean, firstly, the war is not over, so it feels a bit previous, and I'm sure the intention is good, but I think the trauma of this war is going to reverberate for decades. Will this retrofitting project help that? You know, maybe it does something about the physical trauma, but will it address this kind of collective psychological trauma that's going to exist for a long time? Would it be better for those companies involved to, for example, invest in grassroots organisations in Kharkiv that are working to rebuild communities over the long term? You know, just give them the money to get on with it. I'm a bit suspicious of that kind of overt saintliness. For example, I always really liked that story that came out after George Michael died, which is that he'd volunteered regularly for a homeless shelter, but he'd never told anyone, you know, and he asked the other volunteers to keep it a secret. And I think that's a real one. You know, do the good stuff. That's its own reward. You don't need to talk about it. If you're doing it, you're doing work, and that's its own work.
But yeah, just to flip that on its head, though, like look at something like the Carnegie Libraries, like, which, you know, who doesn't love those? Like amazing architectural heritage, or like Peabody, for example, like, you know, someone who, you know, was motivated to do something for social good. Like, can we really turn our back on what has been a transformative thing in human history and certainly in architectural history?
I mean, it's interesting. The Carnegie thing obviously has been a good thing, but, you know, I do think context is important. It was the Gilded Age and all the rest of that and, like, you know, huge fortunes and wealth. And sure, there's the philanthropic element and that still exists and the buildings are still around, they're public buildings, public libraries. But part of that is, you know, cementing your name in history for all time. And that's been very successfully done too. You know, Andrew Carnegie, we know who he is. Great guy. You know, it's also about that kind of reputation storing, I suppose. And personally, I feel a little bit chafed by that idea.
So we're going on to the culture section. So first up, a few open city things. We've got the Architecture on the Thames boat tour of central London. It's happening on the afternoon of Saturday, the 18th of May. We'll be taking in the sights of the newly restored Battersea Power Station, Kieran Timberlake's American Embassy. Then heading downriver, our guide will explore the design history of Michael Hopkins' imposing Portcullis House, the neoclassical Somerset House, and Renzo Piano Shard, and much, much more. So to find out more about that, purchase your tickets, just go on to the Open City website. Also, an important notice that we are now open for applications for Open House Festival 2024. The final deadline for submitting your application to list a sort of building, place, event, neighbourhood, etc. is 5 p.m. on Monday, the 1st of July. That's coming up. This year, we're running a series of online surgeries to support you with planning and running your festival open days and events. Each surgery will cover a different topic and there'll be plenty of opportunities to ask questions. The next session, which is on Thursday the 9th of May, is how to complete an application for Open House Festival, and following sessions on Thursday the 23rd of May we'll look at running your open day or event, and on Thursday the 6th of June we'll look at making your open day or event as accessible as possible. Those all happen at midday. The schedule and sign up form are all on our website. The events will happen on Zoom. We'll send out invites in advance, and obviously if you can't make any particular online surgery, don't worry, we'll record all of them and share them at the bottom of the online page. So, Alper, what's coming up on your cultural radar? Like, what shows have you been to see recently, or what books or podcasts or other things should our listeners be scouring the internet for?
Yeah, you know what? I went to the Enzo Mario exhibition at the Design Museum, which is on for a while, and I really recommend that one. And also just to say that after he died, which was quite recently, he's bequeathed his whole collection to, I want to say, the City of Milan. Apologies to the Italians if I've got it wrong. And has asked that it's not exhibited for 40 years' time because he doesn't think it's going to be fully appreciated within that 40 years. So you've got to see this exhibition now because it's your last time that you'll see his work for 40 years.
And what do they have on display? What's it, a mix of like photos, drawings?
Yeah, a mix of all of those things. So it's great to see his drawings. There's loads of photographs. He was really interested in play and like imaginative play. So there's lots of toys, graphics, furniture, but then also kind of objects that he'd collected and bits of drawings and so on. So it's well worth seeing.
Alper, it's been an immense pleasure to feature you on the show, and I hope you can come on the show again in the future. Where should our listeners go to stay up to speed with the work you're doing? For example, is there a website or social media handle they should log on to?
I've got a website that's alperdepani.com. I do try and keep that updated with news and bits of work and so on. And on Instagram, alperromp, you can find me there.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Merlin. It's been fun.
You've been listening to The Brief from Open City, made in association with the London Society and the 20th Century Society. This show is made possible in part thanks to Bloomberg Connects, a free digital guide to art and cultural organisations around the world. A link to download Bloomberg Connects is in the show notes. If you've enjoyed The Brief and want to know more about any of the stories we've discussed, we recommend subscribing to The Architect's Journal, which covers all these issues and many more. To get early, ad-free access to The Brief and support Open City's wider work, empowering young people from underrepresented communities, please become an Open City friend today. The link is in the show notes. The Brief is produced by Poppy Waring and hosted by Phineas Harper, Merlin Fulcher, Cyber Chadder and Fran Williams. The series editor is Merlin Fulcher. Our theme music is by Chris Zabriskie. Open City is dedicated to making cities everywhere more open, accessible and equitable.